violence and intimidation and alienation between people, because that's what produces the real pain. I mean,
right.
Penises, you know, I mean, we all, I mean, half of us have one, and the other half know what the story is. Anyway.
One thing they do have is furry handcuffs, and I suggested maybe Officer Over could get some furry handcuffs for when he
arrests.
This
is in the camouflage kind of sex toy department?
Yeah, whips, they have whips. And, you know, those things are fine. I don't mind those things, but when they come around and start telling me that I'm obscene, and I turn around and, you know, look what's in the window, you know, and then commerce on the streets here in Santa Cruz, it's okay if you're paying overhead and you have a building to put something that, well, that I'm sure Pat Robertson would call obscene.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I'm out on the street singing about political issues and how fucked up this country is and how the corporations are taking it over, then that's obscene. You know.
Yeah, well, of course, the obscenity here is the differential standard that's being used.
This is true.
Any other reports, Bob, for many listeners?
That's about it. That's all I know. Otherwise, you know, they're still fucking with drummers, and they're fucking with people who actually sell things on the mall, and who actually, yes, that is their job. Just because they should be paying an overhead, they should be paying a permit or store space, I don't think that's right. I think people should be able to throw their blanket down and put whatever shit they want on it and sell it. Same thing with spare changing, the same thing with playing music. I think all these people are doing their work. There's some musicians that come out there that just do it as a side thing, like the one guy that was in front of Georgiana's Cafe, which, you know, they pay people often to come out and play for the Happy Yuppies.
Oh, so they played illegally in front of Georgiana's Cafe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was one man that was there about a couple days ago that played a very nice, eloquent man, you know, nice dressed up.
Our audience,
you know,
should know that due to the Coonerty Cafe Law, as we call it, part of the downtown ordinance is pushed by then city council member, now still Bookshop Santa Cruz owner, Neil Coonerty. It's illegal to either leaflet at a table or play in front of a sidewalk cafe, anywhere called
Sidewalk
Cafe.
I'm going to have to go do that then.
I'd like to.
Well, this gentleman actually had a chair from Georgiana's Cafe, one of the little green plastic chairs.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sitting in it, and he was playing, you know, very nice songs. It sounds like maybe he was very well off. He had like $20 in his case, and very well-dressed man, you know, nice guitar and everything, not someone who actually needed the money.
Mm-hmm.
And he was probably told to play there by Georgiana's Cafe, so... You know, and then you go down the street and you see the old Latino gentleman with
the violin,
mm-hmm. who's got like, you know, 50 cents in there, and he's told to play over here. And so I'm going to have to go sit there and play someday.
Maybe you could get him to join you, a little violin accompaniment might not be so bad. I think that they want to make Georgiana's a just-kidding free zone, but we'll find out about that.
Yeah, we'll find out. I guess the Metro is supposed to do a little story on our recent impression on the mall.
Oh, boy. Don't hold your breath on that one.
Well, Mike the Mechanic, the guy who did the radio interview,
okay.
He's going to be doing it.
Oh,
so in a couple of weeks, there might be a little story about us in there.
Metro has been promising me that they'd write a letter, that published my letter about the Java House for the last month and a half, and I've seen nothing. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, they're supposed to talk. Actually, he talked to Mr. Stuart Martin, your friend and mine, who's a hero now. I guess he saved some woman from a heroin overdose or something.
That's what a friend of his wrote, or an observer wrote in a letter to the Sentinel, yeah.
Yeah, he interviewed him about that. And that's supposed
did he interview
to
him
up.
About his assaults on homeless people in December? Probably
oh,
not.
They seem to left that out.
Yeah.
But I'm sure we'll talk
about
it.
Well, Stuart is an activist. It's just he seems to be too much of an activist on the wrong side most of the time.
He's a vigilante store owner is what he is.
We're talking about, by the way, Stuart Martin, the manager of the ID building, which is right across from Bookshop Santa Cruz on the corner of Pacific and... you know what the name of that street is?
I don't know, Cooper or something?
Near Cooper, anyway. Who is this? Is this one of those younger musicians that you're bringing up in the family?
He's one of your fans, man.
Oh, good.
He gets up and listens to your show every morning.
Oh, great. Well, I'm gonna move you along. Because
okay, move me along, yeah, just like one of the homeless people.
Moving.
Rolling.
That's right.
Okay, I just want to let you know what's going on. I'm sure more people hear more about it on the radio station because it's an issue that we hear at Just Kidding Enterprises.
And do come to the police review board meeting at 5 o'clock today.
I'll definitely be there.
At City Hall, and I invite the rest of the listeners to come and hear you speak as well.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
And that, of course, was the infamous Skid Marks Bob, Just Kidding musician, who has his own show. In fact, he had a lengthy show last night, which he played some real interesting street interviews, which I really like to hear. Right now, we're going to hear a sweet interview rather than a street interview with the often difficult to reach John Malkin, who's a Citizens Police Review Board commissioner. Before we do, I want to ask Debo if he has any comments on anything that's happened so far. He wants to add or subtract to anything.
No.
Yeah, he's our silent critic here. In case I say something wrong, he's got the hook. He's going to pull me off the air. But here's a little. He's checking things out here, hanging out. There's an interview with, again, Police Review Board Commissioner John Malkin. Let's hear what he has to say, and hopefully soon we'll be hearing from Barbara Riverwoman of the River Street Refugees.
Citizens Police Review Board Commissioner John Malkin. Hi, John.
Hi there, Robert.
It's Sunday evening, I guess the day before Martin Luther King's birthday.
Yes.
And does that kind of mean anything to you, John? You've been on the board now, what, for about a year and a couple of months, right?
Yeah.
How's it looking? Does Martin Luther King's birthday have any particular symbolic significance for you this year as a member of the board?
Huh. It has a lot of significance to me as a person and as someone who is trying to make things better for people generally. I actually pulled out a copy of a book I have by Martin Luther King called Stride Toward Freedom.
Yes.
Yeah. As far as the Police Review Board goes, it's been a very interesting year, and it has been about a year since I've been on the board. It's been about 5 years since I became involved with Police Review.
How did that happen? How did you first get involved in this campaign?
Well, I was a student at UCSC, and I was a community studies student. I had to choose a political or social change organization to become involved with as part of my study, and work with the group and then write a thesis about that work that I did.
Was that Professor Mike Rotkin's class?
He's a community studies professor. He wasn't one of my advisors, although he sat on my orals board when I completed my thesis.
Which was on police review?
It was called the Movement to Establish a Police Review Board in Santa Cruz.
That's right. I remember that.
I think you have a copy of it. Copies are available. I think a copy is up at the library at UCSC. Also, you can get a copy for me if anyone's interested.
Have you thought of putting a copy of that thesis in the Citizens Police Review Board itself?
You know, there is a copy there.
Oh, good.
Yeah, someone can get a copy there.
And the address of that office is?
It's 915 mm-hmm. Cedar Street.
Mm-hmm. Office hours, I think, are what, Monday through Thursday, 9
yeah,
or 1?
Yeah, something like that, 8:30 to 1:30.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other thing that got me quite interested in police and police misconduct was having seen a shooting that involved Santa Cruz police officers. That was a shooting that happened, and actually a man was killed. His name was Carlos Machado. It was about 3 days into the Gulf War. Was that 1991?
That was at Ocean and...
Yeah, at the gas station.
Ocean and Water Streets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a terrible, terrible thing to see happen.
You were actually a witness to that.
I was.
Tell me what you saw.
Huh. It's interesting I haven't ever talked to you about this. I wrote about this in my thesis. I was making a documentary about the response to the war. And in fact, I ended up completing that, and that's available at the library downtown. It's called Santa Cruz Response to the Gulf War.
And that's a video documentary?
That's right.
How long?
It's about half an hour long.
Mm-hmm.
And this event that occurred at the gas station down there was, you know, obviously completely unexpected. There was a group of protesters at the county building. I think folks were going to march to a congressperson's office in Scotts Valley or somewhere, and this guy had, stolen a car and a gun, and had been shooting the gun out the window and of this car as he drove down towards Santa Cruz. He was cornered at the gas station by the county building, and officers jumped off their motorcycles and out of their cars and were surrounding that gas station, and I ran over there, perhaps unwisely.
Perhaps not.
In the sense of the putting myself in extreme danger. But I wasn't aware of what exactly was going on, and I came to the scene and actually videotaped the man at the gas station and the officers then shooting him and killing him. There was a dog, police dog involved. As you're probably aware, the dog was released onto the...
Is that Omar, the police dog?
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, you know, the dog was shot and wounded, and the press reported that quite up front. And I guess having been a witness to this man's killing, I thought it was a little bit insensitive to hype the dog's
injuries
rather than commenting on, you know, this activity and the death of this person.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, the dog, the district attorney ended up saying that they didn't know who shot the dog. And in fact, you know, that was the reason why they said they shot this man, was because he shot the dog as it approached him.
Mm-hmm.
Also interesting, it took me quite a long time to get documents regarding that shooting, the investigation of that shooting. One thing I found out was that when the dog was released towards the suspect, it actually ran and bit a police officer by mistake.
Wow.
And then was called back, and they said, you know, wrong person, and they let him off again, and he ran towards the suspect and then was shot. You know, and apparently the suspect shot the dog. This all happened very, very quickly.
Did you see any of this, or this is all in the reports that you read?
I was standing there.
So you saw this happen?
I saw this happen.
But you weren't aware of it all happening?
Right. I mean, there were so many things going on, I didn't see everything that happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I was standing there, and this I included the footage that I taped in this documentary that's called Santa Cruz Responds to the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it couldn't help but affect my perspective on the war and on...
the police department?
On the police department and on violence and on nonviolence.
Now, are you a native of Santa Cruz, John?
No, I'm not.
When did you come here?
Just before I started going to school, 1989. I came here,
and you became involved with, I guess, the coalition to establish the Citizens Police Review Board fairly early.
Yeah, you know, as soon as I started going to UCSC, and was narrowing down the possibilities of what kind of political work I would be doing in regards to my community studies work, I got involved with the Christic Action Team right when I came to Santa Cruz. I was looking for, you know, some place to live where there was a lot of political activity, and here was this group that really appealed to me, and I've been involved with the Christic Action Team up until today, since I moved here, and I started wanting to be more active on local issues. The Christic Institute, as a lot of people are aware, was working on Iran-Contra-related issues, which are very important, very pressing, and still important in a lot of ways.
Daniel Sheehan.
Yeah, but I wanted to focus on local issues, and having seen the shooting and having heard about this new group that was getting together to create a police review board, in fact, the group was established, the Coalition for Police Review Commission was established 6 months before I began my internship with it.
Which was when?
Boy, that was, that's a good question. 1991, sometime.
I think it was established in the fall of 1990.
Well, I'll tell you, it was 6 months before the Rodney King beating that it was established. That was in May.
91.
Yeah.
That would have been probably November, December, or January.
Yeah, something
or
like
December
that.
Of 1990.
Yeah, so, you know, and little did I know that, you know, my internship ended and we still didn't have a police review board, and that would go on for a few more years. And I stayed with it, and the board was finally created, you know, a year and a half ago.
Now, this has actually been coming up in a lot of discussions on Free Radio Santa Cruz and other people's shows, as well as my own. The kind of discrepancy between the national focus and the local focus that often happens, and indeed a number of politicians have earned my ire and critique for talking in sweeping and liberal, or even more than liberal, radical terms about the need for national changes and priorities and changing things in other countries and so forth. But then when it comes to local issues involving, let's say, civil disobedience or the homeless and homeless rights, there seems to be either a silence or often a siding with the local establishment. When you came to Santa Cruz and you began working on issues, did you see any kind of factionalism, and did you notice this? That's one question. Then the second question is, did you notice a kind of a discrepancy between those who were involved in local issues and those who were, should we say, involved in broader general?
Well, that was John Malkin, Citizens Police Review Board Commissioner, and you'll be able to hear him in the flesh if you show up at 5 o'clock today at City Hall, where he will be sitting on the board of the Citizens Police Review Group, and they meet once a month. So this is your chance to jump in on the ground floor and discuss any problems you've had with them, make any suggestions for better policies downtown regarding police practices. There's an open mic, in essence, that happens at Oral Communications. And, of course, tomorrow at noon, you'll be able to come, if you want, to the Citizens Police Review Board subcommittee that talks to the very head of all the police activities in town, our very own Steve Belcher, police chief at large, still at the moment, as far as I know. Also, well, let me kind of seg you here. That was only a tiny part of the John Malkin interview, which we may be able to play later, but don't count on it. If you want to hear more of this interview, if I hear like great numbers of phone calls coming in, I will play more of it at a subsequent program. Give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, if you want to hear more about this interview. If you want to comment on the interview or anything else going on the show, we have open phone lines, 427-3772. And I'm about to introduce you to a brimstone Barbara Riverwoman, who we have finally lured to the station. She's here. She's going to kind of give us a whole overview of what's going on with the River Street refugees and her involvement in that. And before we begin, and I'm going to kind of give the mic over to her for a while to just talk about, and I will ask her some questions as well, I want to point out what she's reminded me of, that the Open Air Shelters Subcommittee, which is the, is it a subcommittee or isn't it? Who knows? It depends whether you talk to Mike Rotkin or Scott Kennedy. Anyway, it's three city council members, two usually, and the third sometimes comes, Celia Scott, Catherine Byers, and I guess once every blue moon, Scott Kennedy, that meets to discuss the question of where is there going to be a place for people to legally sleep come March 15th, actually come tomorrow or come yesterday is what we should be considering, because there ain't no legal place now to sleep outdoors. But certainly March 15th, when the Armory closes, as far as every night, it no longer becomes a nightly matter for the Armory and 80 to 150 people, depending on how full the Armory is at any one time, are let out on the streets with no legal place to sleep at night. What is the city going to do about that? And that Open Air Shelter Subcommittee has been babbling about that issue for the last 6 months to no effect. I mean, they've tromped here and they've tromped there and they've looked for sites here and there, and they ain't found nothing yet, as far as I know. But I'm going to, anyway, if you want to come to that meeting and kind of get a close-up view of How to Waste a Lot of Good Time. It's at 3:30 at the City Manager's Conference Room, which in fact is where the City Council offices are, which is about the same place the City Clerk's office, the City Hall is. Just ask anybody where the Mayor's office is, and you can make your way to this open-air shelter subcommittee at 3:30. I may be there. I suspect, Barbara, you'll probably be there.
I'm working.
No, Barbara knows better. She's going to be doing something else. Anyway, this is the group that has been talking about, you know, where can there be a legal campground? And they've been shooting down sites one after another. Although at the last subcommittee meeting, it must be said, Celia Scott said some positive things about if we can't get anywhere by March, she would recommend some kind of cessation or reform or loosening of the city's anti-homeless sleeping ban. But let's get to the person who's in the studio, who has limited time. Barbara Riverwoman. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Robert.
Barbara, we met each other, back in 1988?
Was it that long ago?
I think so. We have an ancient relationship here, and we both look a little grayer, but I remember seeing you. Weren't you chained to the bathroom fixture in some River Street annex New Year's Eve, 1988?
I think there was a wild moment in my history when I sat in a bathtub with Jane Immler and protested the failure to open River Street shelter on a cold night.
That's right. Yeah, I think what happened there, folks, for all you history buffs, is the River Street mini shelter, as I call it, which now houses about 36 people, 18 of them homeless and 18 mental health people, then housed 14 people, 10 or 12 of them mental health people, and two of them homeless. And we wanted them to open the annex in the winter of 1988 because it was available and all they had to do was open it, but they wanted to remodel it or something. So about 9 or 10 of us all just sat in. Some of them, including Barbara and I guess Jane Immler, were chained themselves to fixtures
No, we didn't chain ourselves.
I remember
we were wearing party hats. You know, one of the things that I've been reading this book, Robert, called Nation in Denial. Mm-hmm. And it came out in 1994, I think. Okay. And I think one of the points it makes is an important point for all of us homeless advocates to remember. You just made the point that River Street was housing mentally ill and just too homeless. I think we need to stop making those kinds of distinctions because probably up to 85% of the homeless in this country, according to figures I've seen, are either mentally ill or drug and alcohol addicted. And this is not to blame. And I think one of the reasons that homeless advocates are worried about speaking honestly about this subject is because we're afraid that if we talk honestly about the serious problems that some of the homeless people have in this country, the society will not be willing to respond. That somehow society can respond more compassionately, and we haven't seen much of that, in fact, but that it will respond more compassionately to people who are homeless than it will to people who have alcohol problems and drug problems, particularly. I think there is some sense that we owe the mentally ill services. And this is definitely a class issue because middle class and upper class people, rehabilitation centers for upper class, middle class people have tripled, quadrupled in the last years since alcoholism was identified as a disease. Whereas rehabilitation centers for the poor, for homeless people, for the poor and homeless people, have been reduced. And I think that's a crime. And in many cases, the services that we want to provide for homeless people, jobs and affordable housing, aren't accessible to people with serious drug and alcohol problems or who are mentally ill. They need an interim step there that just sometimes isn't available, which makes our focus on affordable housing and jobs really, in many cases, irrelevant to the majority of homeless people. So I don't make that distinction. Another point I want to get, well,
hold
can
it.
I...
Now I'm
right.
going to respond to this just a moment. Now, you had your minute and a half. I want to say something about this.
Robert, wait a minute.
Yes.
I only have a few minutes, and I'd like to just... Play out my time here, and then you have plenty of time to respond to. It's a very interesting question, and I think we could have a long dialogue about it. I have another important point that I want to make while I am here, rarely get in.
Go ahead.
Okay.
I surrender.
you're so.
Yes, that's the way to do. Go ahead.
Okay.
Tell us more.
Another thing that...
If anyone wants to cut into Barbara, the phone number is 427-3772. Maybe you'll be more successful.
there's some terminology here that I want to get clear. There's three words that get bandied about, sometimes interchangeably, and I want to clarify that I think they're very different philosophically and practically, and I want us to be real careful about what we're using. One is tent city, one is open-air shelter, and one is campground. The Citizens Committee for the Homeless insisted that the community on the back 40, Highway 1 and Highway 9, during the last 3 years, was an open-air shelter. That meant that it was overnight shelter only, that it was not a place to live 24 hours a day. It was simply a place where people could put up their tents at night and take them down in the morning. Now, to me, an open-air shelter, if that's what open-air shelter means, is not acceptable. Because one of the things I think we need, in addition to a legal and safe place to sleep, is a legal, safe, and dignified place to live. And I understand why the focus of the struggle in this community has been to give people a place to sleep. It's true, that's the bottom line. But a place to sleep, as in the armory, or even in the churches, or in the open-air shelter, as CCH conceived it, is not a dignified answer to the needs of the people. Anybody who's been camping knows to put up a tent and then to take it down in the morning is a real hassle and destroys, to some extent, your sense of security and consistency. Having a place of your own. Many homeless people have told me proudly when they show me their tent that this is my home. What I need is a piece of land, but this is my home. And I think we should accept their definition of a home. An armory, a place where you go to sleep overnight on a mattress, on a floor, next to a stranger, is not a home, nor are the places in the churches.
We have an incoming call. Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz with Barb Riverwoman and Robert Norris.
Yeah, Robert, this is John Stewart. I'd like to speak to the issue of that survey she's talking about the so-called mentally ill and so-called drug abusers amongst the so-called homeless population.
Mm-hmm.
To begin with, there have been no adequate surveys of the so-called homeless population. The attempt in 1990 to include them in the census was an utter failure. You can go read about it. Second thing is that people in poverty suffer from malnutrition, sleep deprivation, and dream interruption, all three of which, as scientific studies with volunteers have shown, and you can read about them in the library, you can find the studies, cause people to have symptoms similar to those of so-called mental illness. So that numerous people on the streets in poverty begin to have these kinds of so-called mental illness symptoms, experiences of seeing things, hearing things, and so forth, and they go to someone or another mental health unit for help. Utterly unethically, the psychiatrists or psychologists or other mental health professionals who are working in whatever mental health unit it is don't take those three factors into account and therefore they don't provide them with housing and security, say, for 6 months to a year before they do a psychological or psychiatric evaluation of them. They evaluate them in their poverty-stricken, destitute state, which is utterly unethical in any sense of the word, in any sense of a psychological examination. To examine someone while they're in a state of sleep deprivation, dream interruption, or malnutrition and call what's going on with them a mental illness is utterly unethical. There are three books at the library Barbara could look at. One is Toxic Psychiatry by Peter Bragan, who discloses the fraudulent methods for producing these psychiatric drugs, which they will eventually put people like that on, and which they do put them on when they come for several days at a mental health unit. In any event, back to the surveys, so people on the streets, they get caught up into the system for a week, a month, and maybe for a lifetime, but a week or a month, and then later at some one or another of the shelters or some one or another of the food kitchens in one of these fraudulent surveys that claim to be all-inclusive and absolutely are not, people are asked, have they ever been in a mental health unit? And they report, yes, they have been. Have they ever been gotten a psychiatric diagnosis? Of course they have by then. But it's all utterly fraudulent science. And that book that she's talking about, A Nation in Denial, is one which is equivalent to an earlier book entitled Madness in the Streets, which is a production of the psychiatric pharmaceutical industry and the Alliance for the Mentally Ill, which is a shill for the psychiatric pharmaceutical industry and for solutions of forced psychiatric treatment and involuntary psychiatric interventions in people's lives. Along with Toxic Psychiatry, you could look at the book Decarceration or Mental Social Order, Mental Disorder, or the book Out of Bedlam, all three of which are far more scholarly endeavors than that Nation in Denial, and report that, in fact, that those reports of so-called population of homeless with a high percentage of so-called mentally ill drug abusers is fraudulent. The other thing is that people in desperate straits use
John, can I just interrupt a minute? You know, my experience has been that I'm relatively new to this whole advocacy movement. Talking to you.
Yeah.
In terms of homeless advocacy, although I've sort of been in and out of it for the last 8 years, as Robert indicated. I have not seen personally, and I want to talk just basically from my own experience. It's hard to talk, you know, about one book or another book. In terms of my own experience, I have not personally seen a lot of mental illness. And I certainly acknowledge what you're saying, that the one produces the other, and I think that's also true in terms of alcoholism and drug abuse, that homelessness, poverty produces...
I say it produces mental illness. I say it produces experiences which are
equivalent to diagnosed to, yeah. And this is really... I actually didn't mean to talk about this morning.
You have far more...
Well, it's a very important issue.
It is a very important issue. I wanted to make...
Absolutely. The reason...
I wanted to bring to people's attention, though, this book, which I do think raises an important issue when homelessness is simply talked about in terms of, and providers that I've known who have been in this field a lot longer take this book seriously. So I would love it if you could have a chance to really play this out, because you're obviously an expert in this, and I don't want to argue with you. I really wanted to talk about shelters in tent cities.
Well,
and I only have 15 minutes.
That's just the problem. People with very well-meaning people such as yourself with good intentions are taken in by books such as this, which is why I say you should read the other books.
I wrote down the one.
Just a moment.
I didn't write down the other two because you didn't say them.
Toxic
Psychiatry. And the other two are?
One is Decarceration by S-C-U-L-L.
Uh-huh.
Toxic Psychiatry is by Bragan.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is Out of Bedlam.
Oh, okay.
And I've forgotten the author of that.
Okay, I wrote them down. Good.
But just in the local area, recently there was a survey reported on the news a survey of homeless people in San Mateo County that showed that one-third of them are employed. If one-third of the homeless people in San Mateo is fairly representative county are employed, how can it be that 85% of them are so-called mentally ill drug abusers in need of some kind of mental health service? That's absurd. Let me make one more point.
Look at the federal administration.
The point is this. I've been in the mental health system. I've been locked up. I've been force treated. I've been homeless. I've been living on the streets. I've been scraped off the streets. And books. Am I being heard?
Yeah, you're being heard, John. I'm, and what you're saying is very important. But sum it up because Barbara's going to run off.
I will. But the importance of it is this: if you don't have the direct experiences that I do, and you're taken in by these books. I appreciate your well-meaning and your intentions, but I would like you to have informed before you begin to take a book like that seriously. That's my basic point.
Gotcha. And John, can she contact you later to get more information?
Yeah, 427-3772. No, that's your number. You can give her my number. It's up there on the wall, but I don't want to give it on the air.
I will.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Bye.
Yeah.
I've always had a lot of respect for John and his work, and it's interesting because just last night I was talking to a person out at the campground who was incarcerated when he was 13 years old in a mental health institution because he didn't like to go to school, and it's probably the worst experience of his life.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, you're on the air again with Barbara Ruhlman and Robert Norris.
Hi, Robert. This is Bear. I'd like to say hi to Barbara.
Barbara, say hi to Bear.
Hi, Bear.
Hi, I'm calling about the homeless and the mentally ill.
Uh-huh.
I've been homeless most of my life, and it was for the escape, you know, a lot of things from when I was a child, you know, a lot of things happened to me. It caused me to have mental problems, and it caused me to be addicted to drugs, you know. And I'm all for this open air, you know, air shelter, you know,
uh-huh.
for people that can have a place to, you know, keep their tents up. But the only thing wrong with that is you have drug problems, people who want to deal drugs, people who want to take advantage of the mentally ill and get their money from them.
Mm-hmm.
You have that problem. You know, I see it all the time. And there's, like, I was fighting a losing battle when I was in the back 40. You know, I'm very grateful I had a place to live, and I think, you know, that we got to come to some kind of resolution to have an open-air shelter all the time. But you got these people, you know, who are trying to stay clean and sober, who have a mental ill problem, you know, who are homeless, but they're fighting this, you know, problem with people selling drugs. You know, there's drugs all around. There's little kids, you know, and they see this. That's not good. We got to find some other way to have an open air shelter, but keep the drugs out of it. You know, the hard drugs. You know, because
you know, I couldn't agree with you more. And one of the reasons that I'm so excited about what's happened with the River Street refugees out at New Brighton is we have a model of what can happen in a campground where it can really work. First of all, it's a real campground. It's not an open air shelter, and it's there are designated sites, and there are a limited number of people, and it's well supervised by the park rangers. People are made to leave if their behavior is out of control. There isn't a rule that alcohol can't be used, but if alcohol is abused, people are out. And
right.
The rangers have been pretty clear about that. And the campers themselves have actually voted out several people who created so much stress within the campground that it made it impossible for the other people to get their lives together. I think that can work. I think
yeah,
the combination
of campground.
I use campground. I don't use open air shelter because to me, the way open air shelter has been used in this community means that it's a place where people can spend the night and then they're out in the morning. And I don't like that model.
I don't either. I don't either.
I don't think that's a dignified way to live. I think when a tent is your home, you don't ask people to take their home down every morning. So I am very adamant about using the word campground and not open air shelter. It's not a tent city. I think the public authorities like to say, well, look up and down the coast, all the campgrounds or all the open shelters have been shut down. What they're talking about are the tent cities, and the tent cities are something completely different. That is a political action. People illegally occupy a piece of land to demonstrate the extremity of the need of homeless people for land, and it's an act of civil disobedience. It's a political action. It's an action to educate the community. But they haven't worked as real campgrounds because of some of the problems that you've brought up. I think with the political will from the community and involving the homeless themselves in governing a campground, I think it can work. And I think the River Street Refugees have proved that it can work. And the River Street Refugees, with community supporters, with the park rangers, you know, this sort of triad, has been able to make a campground really work. And I'm still hopeful that the city will see its way to supporting this kind of a thing.
Yeah, I really want to see an open air shelter, a place where people can, you know, think of it as a place as their home. But we got to keep, I mean, it's okay if a person, you know, can drink a little bit of alcohol and be cool about it, you know, not become an alcoholic and have problems with it, same way with drugs, you know. But when that happens, like, I was trying to stay clean. I had, I'm very grateful. I'm living in a house now. You know, I'm very grateful for that. This is the first time in a long time. But when I came clean and sober, the first 2 months I was clean, I had people coming up my tent wanting to fix in my tent and want to get me high. That's, you know, and these people would supposedly be my friends.
Actually, that's one of the reasons that some of us oppose the community house project located where it is, which is right next to emergency services at the site of the former open air shelter. But Barbara has 3 minutes left here. Let me ask you to kind of conclude, so we can. I want to ask her a question or two before she leaves. I probably am not going to have time to get an answer. But anything you want to say before you go?
I just want to say there is a way to do it without having drugs,
mm-hmm.
you know, involved. There is a way.
No, I think we need a new society not to have drugs involved. That's what I think.
Yes, the society that we live in is totally messed up.
Yeah.
Like, I talked to you that I'm writing a story, and I want to share it to people.
Well, let's talk more about that on the next show.
Okay.
I'm sorry to hustle you off, but I want to grab Barbara before she leaves.
Okay.
Thanks, Bear.
Yeah, thanks for hearing me.
Whoops, sorry, didn't hear that, folks. I want to give Barbara a chance to do some more talking in a subsequent show. I also want to just say very briefly, I haven't read the book that Barbara's been reading, and so I cannot comment knowledgeably upon it. I do know that a rush of right-wing books has come out in the last 5 or 6 years justifying anti-homeless laws, anti-homeless programs, and essentially a dismissal of the homeless population as something that can be handled by drug programs, alcohol programs, and mental, quote, illness programs. Whereas, in fact, I think a large percentage of the homeless population is, A, people who have fallen below the line for different reasons, namely housing and the fact that a wage buys, what is it, a third of what it bought in 1970, something like that. There's been a huge drop in income possibilities in this country. And secondly, you have people choosing alternate lifestyles. And these people are not mentally ill, they're not drug abusers, and they're not alcohol abusers. I mean, that may happen in that population, but there are a lot of people in these populations that are just transient and have chosen to take another lifestyle. And it's dangerous to look simply at the social service provider. I call them poverty pimps, because there are a class of people that make a lot of money off of these programs. And the money doesn't get to the campground people who want to buy the pallets and set up the tents, as Barbara has done. She has been a literal support system for the River Street Refugees for the last 3 or 4 months, along with Sherry Connable and other members of the community. You don't have that happening. What you essentially have is very expensive programs being set up that pay middle-class people to track homeless people and to categorize them and so forth. So I think that's a concern I have there. Now, Barbara, what do you want to say about the campground you think that might be helpful for the next 5 days? How can people help out there? What kind of help do you think they need? And what can you tell us in the next 2 minutes or 20 minutes if you want to stay?
Well, what I want to say is that in this short time, I think is that I agree with you, Robert. I think there are some people among the homeless community, some very, very important people, who are challenging some of our dearest assumptions about how we should live. And they're challenging the whole system. And they're choosing a lifestyle that isn't acceptable in this country, but on some level is a lifestyle that treats the earth more reverently and uses less resources and challenges the existing government structures in a way that I think is visionary. And I do believe that there are some real visionaries among the homeless. It's very mixed up. And what I'm saying, I think what those of us who are struggling to get a campground are saying is that there needs to be a place for everybody who needs a safe and legal and dignified place to live. We have the right to land. Nobody put labor into land, and everybody, by virtue of being born on this planet, has a right to a piece of land. That certainly goes against all our private property laws, but it certainly doesn't go against the visions of Tolstoy and prophets in the Bible who said the land belongs to all, and lots of other people. So on the most basic religious, philosophical level, that's what I believe. On a purely, you know, emergency level, we can't drive people under bridges and behind bushes and threaten their very lives. I don't think a campground is a solution to the problem of homelessness, but it's an emergency measure, and it's something that we have to find the political will to do in this community. And on some level, it creates a community of people that is the envy of a lot of people isolated in nuclear families and isolated within four walls. What's going on among the River Street refugees, in many ways, is something that is very exciting in terms of where our society could move. And in some ways, it's not solving the problems that some of them have to move back into.